and
the volunteers. And, yep. And it's unique. It's the only thing that we have. You know, one of the things I like to say about it is that KBOO, because it's heard globally via the website,
yes,
it is a it promotes Portland values.
Yes.
Outward. So once more, the number is 877-500-5266. And thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Flamenco Syndrome on Friday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Flamenco Syndrome is a documentary film focusing on international flamenco, which reflects on how to sing and dance to the songs of others and in the process reveal one's essence. Again, that's Flamenco Syndrome on Friday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are tuned in to KBOO Portland. The time is 12:01. Coming up next here on News and Public Affairs Day is a special from the host of The Food Show. So make sure you give us a call while you're waiting for that to come on, 877-500-5266.
Let's move to the country. Let's move to the country, just you and me. My travels are over. My travels are through. Move to the country, just me and you. A goat and a monkey, a mule and a flea. Move to the country, just you and me.
Dr. Jason Bradford is joining us by phone today from Corvallis, where he founded a farmland management fund and lives on an organic farm. He's the board president at the Post Carbon Institute. Welcome, Jason.
Hey, thanks for having me, Emily.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us on the KBOO News and Public Affairs Day about the climate crisis. Earlier this year, you released a report called The Future is Rural, Food System Adaptations to the Great Simplification. In the report, you highlight some of the ways we got to this kind of crazy, globalized, unsustainable food system that we have now. You talk about resilient science and what we need to know to grow food with fewer resources and share tactics to change our food system. So I've been reading the report. It's fascinating. But I had never heard of the Great Simplification before. So let's start with that. Can you explain what the Great Simplification is? And just so everybody knows, that's like capital G, capital S, simplification. Can you tell us what that is?
Well, sure. Yeah, that's a great question to start with. And it's really getting to the heart of the matter where energy and the superabundance of energy that we've had, starting from the Industrial Revolution to really going into overdrive in the 20th century as oil really came online. And with oil, you have this transportation fuel that's incredibly dense and incredibly versatile. And that just led to really rapid population growth, economic growth, and the idea that we could have almost a globalized society as opposed to these local regionalized societies, which is what humans had always lived with. And what comes with that is what's known sort of in economics and sociology is complexity. And so when you are basically integrating, the world economy, you're creating layers and layers of systems, business systems, bureaucratic, political systems, all these agreements and the financialization of transactions. And that is in stark contrast to societies which are simpler in many forms. And those might be that, the relationships are more, personal relationships are more important. There's not these sort of legal transactions for everything. There's not so much of a monetary system. You can think of simple hunter-gatherer societies or localized peasant, cultures. They don't really have trade, so big trade outside of their local region. They trust one another and know one another or not. But for the most part, if you could look at levels of complexity, we are now the most complex civilization ever to form on the planet. And the only reason we've been able to get to where we are is because of essentially the unique properties and the level of abundance of fossil fuels we have. And so when we talk about the Great Simplification, we talk about this decline of this form of energy in its scale and cost. And it doesn't, snap your fingers and go away overnight, but it does lead to problems that make globalization less tenable and unwind over time. And that's what we mean by the Great Simplification.
Cool. Thanks for that explanation. Sure. You also, in the report, you emphasize that, renewable energy is not the answer. We're not going to get to a replacement of fossil fuels to keep up the level of industrial agriculture that we have. Renewable energy is just not going to get us there. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Why is that?
Yeah, and this is something that is really important to get across, because there's this sort of myth that we have that because we've grown up, all of us have lived through tremendous era of technological progress and advancement. We kind of imagine that there's going to be, a new rabbit pulled out of the hat just in time to solve the problems of the world. And I think people are getting less and less, comfortable or, confident in that. There's a lot of unease if you see how really wacky the political system is right now, and problems are not getting solved as projected or expected, and there's a lot of unrest. And what you get with renewable energy systems is they are a way of really adding complexity to energy systems that we don't have right now. So right now you have an electric grid that has a certain amount of base load of hydropower or nuclear or coal fire or natural gas plants that kind of on demand can help us manage our electric grid. So right now the grid managers, for example, have to keep supply and demand of energy in the grid within about a 1% tolerance, which is pretty remarkable. Everyone flipping on and off light switches and industrial plants turning on and off for processes, and they have to deliver within 1% supply and demand to keep the grid stable. And so with renewable systems, you have a lot of intermittency, and it leads to a huge amount of problems of managing that. And then the other thing to think about is the most important by a quantity of energy of any supply we use is actually oil. And so it's very hard to take you can't replace oil very easily with electrical systems, which is what we have as sort of our renewable technologies are these electrical system replacements. But oil is, and the work that oil does is very hard to do with electricity.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of examples of that for farms. Especially.
Right, tractors and everything that makes everything go. Wow. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break to talk a little bit about the KBOO membership drive that we're doing right now, but we'll come right back. And I want to talk a little bit more about local food and the changes that we need to make our food system more sustainable as we move into the future.
Sounds great.
And we are live from Membership Central, back in the inner sanctum of KBOO. This is Ravia, and I am coming to you today on News and Public Affairs Day. I got exciting stuff, as if there wasn't enough excitement in the air. We have, check this out, $1,500 match that's available just for today. And what that means is that some generous KBOO supporter has said, hey, you guys, your listeners, when your listeners donate, I will match that. So if you call in right now, donate your $60 or $10 a month, $120 a year, whatever it's going to be. We have a generous individual who has said, I will match that. I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's $60. I don't care if it's $1,500. If it's $1,500, I'll match it because that's the match. So make that match happen, 877-500-5266. And we've got goodies. We've got thank you gifts. So check it out. We are offering copies of Naomi Klein's new book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. That's for a donation of $120 or more. The main thing is we want to make you a member. You're a member or your membership is last, or you just want to renew, give a call now, 877-500-5266, because here's the deal. It's weird. Things are weird out there. There's a lot of crazy stuff going on. And it's unprecedented. The main thing is that you won't hear about, you only hear kind of this moderate, temperate, sanitized version of the news, except on KBOO. We're going to bring to you all day today the real deal. 877-500-5266. You're listening because you value it. You are enriched by what you hear on KBOO, and that's why you're listening, even during membership drive. I'm crazy too. I listen during membership drives. 877-500-5266. Help us kick off this hour with your donation. If you've been a listener, never been a member, we want to make you a member, a gigantic, huge member. 877-500-5266. That's the number for you to call. And we've got very intelligent and attractive phone answerers here just waiting to assist you. It takes about 3 minutes. 877-500-5266. Call now.
Thanks so much, Ravia. So we're going to keep talking with Jason Bradford from the Post Carbon Institute. We're talking about what's the future of the food system? What is the climate crisis? What's its impact going to be in Portland and kind of in U.S. cities in general? We just have this huge abundance of food, and it's really inexpensive. Most of it's not raised locally. It's not seasonal. And, you know, people are pretty happy with that situation. It's pretty great that you can have grapes and broccoli any time of year. So Jason, what are some of those like really urgent reasons that we need to relocalize our food systems, and what kinds of arguments do you have that actually convince people that they need to make changes?
Well, that's a great question. I think you're right. I think we do have an incredible abundance of food, and it's generally healthy. I mean, you could definitely eat unhealthy food, but there's probably more availability of diverse, wonderful, delicious, healthy food from anywhere in the world that any, you know, civilization in history has ever had. So, like, you know, what's wrong with that, right? And I guess you can think of it from a number of angles. If you want to look at it from the perspective of of pollution and climate change and biodiversity loss, there's obviously tons of issues related to that, you know, or we're losing soil very quickly. The practices put in place to deliver that food to us in such abundance and so cheaply are really undermining, you know, the ecosystems of the planet. And so I get into that a bit in the report as well. And climate change, obviously, is, you know, a big issue of this week. And so if you look at the food system and how much energy it takes, and energy use is then directly related to CO2 emissions, it's quite a bit. It's you know, up in the teens percentage-wise of emissions globally. And then you start adding land use change. And so that's carbon being put into the soil because we're clearing areas, and the worst areas are like tropical forests, clearing those for expanding mostly corn and soy production. Some of that goes into beef as well, but that corn and soy then goes into, you know, the concentrated industrial products that we get. It might be chicken, it might be pork, but it, you know, kind of almost anything industrial food wise they turn it into something, right? The manufacturing of food. And so we have those problems of environmental destruction. But then we also have the energy situation. If you look at how much energy goes into produce a unit of food, so let's say you have a plate of 1,000 calories on your plate, you know, a nice hearty meal, about 10,000 calories went into making that to get into your plate. So it's an energy loss, which is really bizarre. If, you know, if you were a deer and you were foraging, you know, browsing around the neighborhood in Portland, and you got one return, you know, calorie for every 10 you used, you wouldn't be around very long. And so the report really highlights the energy disparity between food system we have today and what the food system needs to be sustainable from an energetic perspective. And that's where we have a huge amount of work. And fortunately, you know, there's a possibility that you solve both the environmental externalities and the energy quandary through, you know, really massive transformational changes in the food system.
Yeah. So I don't know if you heard at the top of the show, but we played a little song. It said, "Let's move to the country." Uh-huh. It's a smog song. And you know, that's kind of the like sensational and exciting part of your report. It's you say that humans in general, we're going to stop migrating to cities and we're going to need to move to the country. We're going to move back. And it's not going to be like a fun, happy, back to the landers movement. It's going to be a forced change where we're just going to have to do that to eat. So can you talk a little bit about what this re-ruralization might look like or feel like and how you think it might happen?
God, that's so hard to know, isn't it? Because it's almost easier to see ahead, say, 100 years and realize when things have settled out, then just understand the next, you know, 20 to 40 years when there's probably going to be pretty wrenching changes and how that happens. And I wish it would be fun, and there's a chance it could be, but only if we actually do this proactively and there's general social support and understanding for it. And what, you know, with report discusses is like, we're really, you know, we've got our head in the sand and we're in denial about the reality of the energy situation. And we don't understand how cities function and what keeps them going energetically and materialistically. And because we're in denial, it's likely going to be crises that drive the migration. And that's unfortunate because, you know, it's a reactive mode. So what it does suggest is that that activists that understand this sort of try to kind of pre-adapt the food system for changes that will become inevitable. And this might be anything from like land use law, right? So how easy is it to re-ruralize from an actual housing point of view and a legal point of view? Or do you have farms in your area that are training grounds for young or not even not so young, middle-aged farmers who want to really get into this career before it's necessary, right? And so I think there's tons of work that can be done to ease that transition, but the report also does say that it's likely going to be driven by crises management because we, you know, for the most part, we don't have sort of the larger top-down systems appreciating what's needed. But there's a lot you can do to at least when crises occur, help the system shift more gracefully. And so that's, you know, those are, there's a lot, there's almost any perspective you can take, you know, you can be useful, is what I sort of advocate.
And I guess, you know, as I think about it, I think that the impact on people in cities is going to be huge, but the impact on people in rural areas is also going to be huge. So it seems like not just people in cities need to prepare and, you know, learn how to grow food and things like that, but also people in the rural areas, especially in the U.S., that's going to be a big shift for them too, to have it be not a quiet, peaceful life anymore and have a lot more people migrating back out.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting situation because you've got the situation now where, you know, one farm worker on average can feed 100 people in the U.S. It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
And so you get this rural depopulation. If people aren't needed in the rural areas, then it depopulates. But then that leads also isolation in the rural areas where maybe it's, yeah, quiet and peaceful, but it'll also be kind of lonely. And you lose services. So once your population levels decline, these, it's, you know, small towns and hamlets, you lose things like schools and post offices and banks and the local general store and the local pub, you know, all the things that make life interesting from a social perspective kind of start disappearing. And so the rural gutting of rural America has been really sad in many ways. So part of what the upside of this could be is that, you know, people need people and it's more interesting that way. And though, although it's going to be culturally kind of wrenching, it also could be reinvigorating. And so that's sort of maybe the upside to this. And but also you've got the people that know the land right now, you know, a lot of the conventional farmers are really steeped in the methods they have going for them right now, the conventional agricultural methods, mm-hmm. the commodity, the big equipment. And that worries me quite a bit, is they're not thinking about this. And
yeah.
So you kind of need a combination of maybe new energy, new ideas with kind of the old, you know, entrenched folks that live there now that know something about the land and agriculture, even if it's incomplete.
Yeah, let's take another quick break and talk about agroecology and some other ecological farming methods when we come back. And we'll talk a little bit more about our membership drive with Ravya.
Sounds good.
Are you there, Ravya?
We're going to talk to Jenna right now. And in my pitching, give us a call to become a member of KBOO right now, 877-500-5266. Again, that number is 877-500-5266. And don't forget, if you can come in at $10 a month, we will send you, as a thank you gift, Naomi Klein's new book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. And if you tuned in this morning at 8 a.m., then you heard Barbara Bernstein doing that interview. And of course, today is News and Public Affairs Day, which is why we are offering that book from Naomi Klein. And while you're hearing the discussion right now here on air, where we're talking about the future of food and what does that look like for our every single day lives, right? Because, well, our theme today for News and Public Affairs Day is the climate crisis. If you haven't noticed, it's, you know, it's kind of happening. And so you are enjoying this, I want to say it's a difficult discussion, but I know I'm enjoying it because I'm enjoying hearing people actually talking about it and what does this look like and what does this look like for our future and how can we imagine ourselves in it so that we can actually approach it and do something about it. Give us a call. Show us your support for this type of discussion, which apparently is very radical. 877-500-5266. Again, that's 877-500-5266. And don't forget that if you can come in on News and Public Affairs Day special, guess what? You are going to have your funds matched because we have a very generous $1,500 match available just for today. So it is the perfect time to call in because if you are able to come in at that $10 a month, guess what? It gets doubled without you having to do anything. I don't know anything in life that's like that. Oh, we got Rabia with us. Rabia, what do you know that you can get where you put in a dollar and it becomes two? It's like magic.
That is magic. I like to have some of that magic happen to me, but it can happen to you and it can happen to KBOO. Just give a call, 877-500-5266. Whatever amount you're going to donate, that will be matched. That's happening all day. We've got for that $10 a month ongoing membership, we've got Naomi Klein's new book on FIRE, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. We heard from Naomi this morning, and we are in a climate crisis and a number of other crises, which KBOO is holding your hand and walking you through. 877-500-5266. That's the number to give us a call right now to make your donation. And we are going to be continuing on at 12:30. We're going to be talking about mushrooms. So keep
tuned
in. Food
discussion continues.
That's right.
So let's get back to our discussion right now, where apparently we're all going to move to the country in not such a joyful way. But I'm curious to hear more about it. So back to Emily. Here we go.
Jenna. Thanks, Jenna. So we were talking a little bit about how people in rural areas and rural communities might benefit from an influx of new people, but then also how our farming methods are going to have to change. Can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, what can people do to prepare for this kind of shift that might happen?
Well, I guess, you know, some of the things to prepare is just to learn about the sort of the historic methods that were used that were less energy intensive, and also sort of the modern sort of versions of these that are practiced around the world. And in the U.S., there's different schools of thought. So, you know, they all have this sort of what you might call an agroecological bent to them. So what that really means is this fusion of agronomy and ecology. So agronomy is the practice, the science and practice of agriculture, and then ecology is the science of the relationships among all the different forms of life and sort of the broader environment. And so what we have now is this industrial system that has kind of replaced a lot of these common relationships. So it might be between the fungus and the soil and the plant, and that has been disrupted. And those are the kind of relationships that will have to come back and be nurtured. So it's a really relationship-heavy, really knowledge-intensive system of farming that requires much more management by people that are really caring and observant. And that's something that we, you know, I think I live in country here and farm myself, and you see the problem of scale where the fields are huge relative to the people that are managing them. You can get on these giant 500 horsepower tractors and cover so many acres. And what you're doing is you're applying this technology across the land, and the land is so variable, actually. You see swales and you see well-drained areas, but you really can't manage at that scale. You're managing for the scale of these big machines. And so having more people on the land really paying close attention and nurturing these relationships, you're going to have a more tailored approach to the landscape and what you do on it. So I think, you know, people can do a lot of work just to understand these things, and even in the garden scale, but also getting out to rural areas, finding ways to you know, volunteer or help your local watershed and watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts. There's tons of work to do. You know, instead of tearing out trees in riparian areas, it's rebuilding those so you have pollinators and insects, and you know, you work with the wildlife as much as you can to maintain, you know, balance in populations of potential pest species and to enhance the beneficial species. So a lot like that will happen. It can be pretty beautiful in the long run.
Yeah, you mentioned a lot of things that people can do to kind of start to get ready for the shift. One of the things I love that you point out in the report is like, you're like, yeah, everybody should learn to cook with the seasons, preserve food. That's great. But yeah, we also won't have kitchens as we know them in the future. And so we need to start thinking about how we can change the infrastructure of how we live and how we prepare food. Yeah. Like, we might not have gas or electricity to have stoves. So what are we going to do? Like, do we all start cooking on fires outside? Do we not have individual kitchens? We just have a communal kitchen where we all share. Like, who knows? Like, what could happen? And I love that your report kind of brings up a lot of those questions and ideas, and you don't give us answers. You just ask us to think about it.
I don't have all the answers.
Yeah. So tell us where people can find the report.
Yeah, sure. It's published by the Post Carbon Institute, and so you can go to www.postcarbon.org and then look under publications.
Awesome. Well, Jason Bradford, thank you so much for joining us today on KBOO.
Thank you so much, Emily. It was a great opportunity, and best wishes with the fun drive.
Thank you.
Let's move to the country. Let's move to the country.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Pearl Bakery, a bakery located in the Pearl District at 102 Northwest 9th Avenue. Pearl Bakery was founded locally in 1997, featuring artisan breads, pastries, and coffee. More information can be found at pearlbakery.com. Lunch was provided by Horse Brass Pub, located at 4534 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. Open from 11 to 2 a.m., serving British and pub grub. More information can be found at horsebrass.com. Dinner was provided by Di Nicola's, located in the Creston Kenilworth neighborhood at 3520 Southeast Powell Boulevard. Di Nicola's authentic Italian restaurant has been a family-run Portland institution for over 40 years, serving Italian cuisine and pizza, open daily from 4 to 9 p.m. or later. For information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm/give right now.
And you are tuned into KBOO Portland. The time is 12:31. Coming up next, Fantastic Fungi.
Let us turn our attention to mushrooms. A lot of the time when we discuss the climate emergency, we tend to focus on plants and animals. When I mention fungi, maybe you think of a moldy piece of bread. Maybe you think of psychedelic mushrooms. The fungal world and its potential uses are actually a lot broader than that. I spoke to Louis Schwartzberg, the director of the new documentary, Fantastic Fungi. Louis is recognized as a pioneer in high-end time-lapse cinematography. His past works include Wings of Life, as narrated by Meryl Streep, Mysteries of the Unseen World, and the Moving Art series on Netflix. So we're talking today about Fantastic Fungi, which I did get to see a screener of. I heartily enjoyed it. So Louis, how did you get involved with this project?
Well, I think it's a lifelong journey that brought me to doing a film about mushrooms. When I graduated from UCLA, I wanted to shoot high resolution 35 millimeter movie film, couldn't afford it. So I basically pioneered time-lapse photography by building a DC motor that would take these old clunky animation cameras outdoors. And that turned me on to shooting things like sunrises and clouds and flowers opening. And that led me into the reality that when I heard about the bees disappearing, colony collapse disorder, well, you couldn't tell the story of the bees disappearing without telling the story of how they co-evolved with flowers over 50 million years ago. And that became the movie Wings of Life, a Disney nature feature, which is on Netflix. And I told the story of Mother Earth through the voice of a flower narrated by Meryl Streep. And then you ask yourself a bigger question. Well, that's critical for life on our planet. you know, the pollinators, bees, bats, hummingbirds, butterflies, making love to flowers, which gives us our fruit, nuts, and vegetables. What do plants need? Well, they need sunlight, they need water, but they need, most importantly, soil. Where does soil come from? Well, we do a deep dive, and to answer that question, most people don't know that soil comes from fungi. They break down organic matter, they break down rock, and they create this incredible underground fungal network that enables plants to survive. So anyway, I love making the invisible visible, and by looking at life through the point of view of a mushroom or a flower, it broadens our perspective, it opens our hearts, and I think it also elevates consciousness.
So what specifically interests you about fungi and mushrooms?
Well, I've been shooting, as I said, time-lapse flowers and mushrooms for almost 40 years, nonstop, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I squeezed it into 16 hours of film. When I learned that the fungi network under the ground is almost like a shared economy that shares nutrients between trees, you know, the idea that it's all connected is not a hippy-dippy thing. It's scientifically accurate and factual. And that there's this network under the ground that builds community in a forest. It's not a bunch of trees, it's a community. And that enables ecosystems to flourish, not based on greed, but by sharing. And I think it's kind of interesting if we could take that model from below the ground and bring it above the ground.
Totally. So before starting this project, what kind of knowledge of fungi did you have?
Well, before I started this, I really didn't have a lot of knowledge about mushrooms. I had experimented with magic mushrooms in college, which I think had an impact on my life and the kind of filming that I do, because I do love to take people on journeys through time and scale to broaden their horizons and expand their perspective, that, you know, looking at life from the human point of view, which is like we live for 80 or 90 years, is one way of looking at stuff. A redwood tree lives 500 years. A fly might live 4 or 5 days. The idea of being able to expand your consciousness in that way, I definitely feel is a good thing, so we can be more compassionate, more empathetic to all life on this planet. So whether I'm telling the story from the point of view of a flower or the point of view of a mushroom, it is the feminine side of nature that I'm sharing. It's Mother Nature. And I think we need to open our hearts to that.
Yeah. So how does a project like Fantastic Fungi come together?
Come to life?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I typically start the project on my own. And I start filming interviews. I have a vast library, part of which is actually a series on Netflix called Moving Art, where I have gorgeous nature imagery with music and no narration. So I tend to take images from my library and some interviews. I start to put together what's called like a sizzle reel or a trailer. And with that, I reach out to potential supporters, either in the profit or nonprofit world. And little by little, I try to fundraise to get the film made. And this particular film, we've been able to get it to the finish line without having to make a deal yet, which I want to do, to a streaming platform eventually. My goal initially, and the reason why we're in Portland, is because we want to have people come together as a community and not watch it alone on the digital device. We've already sold out, I think, the first couple of shows. It goes to show that there's a movement out there, and we want to be the film that catalyzes the movement.
Right. So, as we discussed a little bit, you've tackled nature as a topic in a number of your films, but was the process different for trying to capture fungi?
Yeah, it definitely was different, because the fungi, especially underground, being the largest organism on the planet, is only one cell thick and is underground, but there's no light. So how do you shoot that? So everything in my film, and people I think have been marveling over the time lapse, which is very challenging to do with mushrooms, but at least it's real, it's truthful, it's honest. And once I got beyond the ability to film things with a microscope we have done some extraordinary computer animation based on scanning electron microscopy of what the underground mycelium network looks like. So these are all extremely challenging and difficult shots to get. But I love the challenge. I love, you know, showing people what is invisible, yet real. It's more mind-blowing to see that than to see a sci-fi movie where you blow up a planet and the brain looks at that and knows it's fake. At least I'm showing things you've never seen before that's real. And that has, a stronger emotional impact.
So like you said, there's these incredible time-lapse shots of fungi overtaking fallen tree branches, mushrooms blooming out of the forest floor. Can you tell me about capturing those sequences specifically?
Sure. Most of the work that I do is done indoors. It all looks like it's outdoors. I don't want to like give away the trick, but the reality is you can't leave a camera outdoors for 3 or 4 weeks and hope to come back and find it. You also have issues with lighting that will flicker and change. We shoot around the clock, so there's no jump in the growth rate. So basically what I do is, indoors is I create like a mini landscape in the studio with grow lights as well as photo lights that come on during the exposure. And this gives us the ability to have a controlled environment where we can control the lighting, control the wind, bugs, insects, and make sure that the equipment isn't stolen or damaged by weather.
That's very interesting. Cool. So Paul, the mycologist in the film, says that he believes that nature is intelligent, and that's explored in different ways throughout the film. Can you tell me about how that idea played into your choices, like thematically?
Sure. Well, nature is intelligent. I mean, think about the fact that almost every, you know, animal and even and definitely all plants communicate chemically, you know, and perhaps we communicate with plants by eating them. That's a chemical connection. But just because they don't speak language, like, you know, that doesn't mean they're not intelligent. We need to kind of lean into their world and try to understand what they are saying to us. And obviously it's intelligent. There's billions of things happening every second, you know, that is the foundation of life. I mean, think about the fact that the cells in your body are communicating with each other, a trillion cells. Without you micromanaging it, where does that intelligence come from?
Right.
Silence?
No, I mean, it's a good question.
Yeah, question, because I don't have that answer. It is intelligent. When a tree falls in the forest, how does the mycelium know? It doesn't have eyes or ears that it's time to come decompose it, right? It's sentient. It's knowledgeable. It doesn't have a brain. It's sort of like the internet. The internet, I would say, is somewhat conscious, the brain, and nobody's driving it. It's the same idea. There are these network patterns in the universe, in our bodies, our circulatory system, our nervous system, our neurological system in our brain. These network patterns have a sense of intelligence and order, and you know, they solve problems, and they are therefore intelligent.
Right. Intelligence isn't just thinking. That's maybe limiting to think of it that
way. Yes. I think in Western science, I think anything that can find food and react to light is considered intelligent. But certainly with indigenous cultures, they've always looked at a forest and understood that it's a spirit, that it's a giant organism, that it is, you know, something that needs to be respected and cared for. And I think when you do that, then you end up falling in love with it, and you'll protect what you love.
And this is Rabia back in Membership Central. Hey, we've got some folks to thank. We want to thank Roger in Beaverton and Howard in Northeast Portland, Richard in Southeast Portland, Jim Dancing Trout, wherever he is. And hey, you know what? This is mind-blowing. I want you to be my psyllium. That's right. You can be my psyllium right now, 877-500-5266, because all of you listeners together, all of our members together, you're like an organism that keeps and feeds this radio station. And we give it back to you. We give you like the nourishment the knowledge, information to feed your brain. So it's a reciprocity and it's working for me. 877-500-5266. Give us a call right now. Be like Roger, Howard, Richard, and Jim. Call 877-500-5266. Be part of this organism that is mutually beneficial, that feeds, we feed each other. And, oh, what did Grace say? Feed your brain. It's all connected, just like mycelium. So call now, 877-500-5266, and get in on the action. But listen, I know I'm making a joke here, and I'm ringing my more Kebu cowbell, but it's dead serious right now. I'm like, what a week, right? Have we not all had kind of like, air quotes, a week? It's crazy out there, and you bring some sanity, stability. When you're listening, you're getting information that truly is not sanitized and homogenous. We're bringing you, we brought you Naomi Klein. Now we're talking with Louis Schwartzberg. And this fantastic fungi is amazing. I'm reading this thing. It says the fungal network that is over 4 square miles under the Mohar National Forest. Incredible. It's like the largest contiguous organism. That's nuts to me. And you know what? Our listeners, you're part of a large contiguous organism too. 877-500-5266. Ring our bell. Make it happen now.
Good afternoon. Hi, Rabia. My name's Sonia. I'm the engineer here. I'm a volunteer, just like Rabia, just like 500 and so other people who all do our part to keep KBOO functioning and humming. And, you know, we rack up a lot of bills in the process, and that's why we turn to you to kind of pitch in and help everybody join in with everybody else who's putting in their pennies, nickels, and dimes, and marry them all together into an annual budget that keeps this station going and keeps it going in the way that it needs to go to be what you need it to be. And there is a very generous member of our community who is stepping up and is challenging all of you to match. They're putting up $1,500, and they're challenging you to put up some of that to match it. Why not call 877-500-5266 right now and be a part of that. Be a part of collective action, of each working for the benefit of all. And Rabia mentioned how Naomi Klein was on this morning, and you can have a copy of her book. Everyone, anyone at all, every single person who contacts KBOO right now and tells us they want to pay
infinite
their radio bill.
Amount. Infinite listeners.
Yes.
That's right.
Just $10 a month or more, right. And we will hook you up. We will ice your KBOO cake with a copy of Naomi Klein's new book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. Anyone, everyone who gives $10 or more each and every month for KBOO, who's ready to make that kind of commitment, we will commit to send you a copy of that book. But you got to do it now. 877-500-5266. $10 per month from you and from a whole bunch of other folks. It all adds up and becomes
a large KBOO connected network.
Yes.
Just like fungi.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, we're about to go back to a bit more of what we're asking you to support. You can do it online and you won't have to miss a single moment of the program. 877, online is kboo.fm/give. If you can multitask, why not call 877-500-5266? However you do it and at whatever level, just do it now.
Let's return to my conversation with director Louis Schwartzberg. So there is this remarkable sequence that illustrated the way that fungi could be used to break down petroleum in the case of oil spills. Because the material is organic, the fungi can break it down and store the carbon underground and ultimately regenerate the effective area into one that's usable for plants and animals. What do you see the role of fungi being moving forward in a world that's increasingly facing a climate crisis?
Yeah, so clearly Look, I didn't know this when I started the film, that potentially fungi could be the greatest natural solution for climate change in its relationship with plants that are doing photosynthesis. So we have that incredible shot in the movie where we watch a CO2 molecule go into the pore of a leaf, oxygen's being released, which we know, we breathe in oxygen, exhale CO2, that's the relationship we have with plants and trees. A carbon molecule goes through the branch, down the trunk of the tree, through the roots, and that carbon is exchanged, you know, with other nutrients it needs from the mycelium network, where the tips of the roots are touching the tips of this underground internet, this network, where they share nutrients with each other, and thereby sequestering carbon back underground, storing it there for thousands of years. And when a plant needs carbon to grow tomorrow or 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now, that carbon is there. It can be utilized to become a new living organism.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, it's a mind blower, isn't it?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, I think we talk about carbon sequestering in, you know, as being a function of, you know, ice loss in the Arctic and stuff like that, but it's not the only way. It's very interesting. So in doing a film about fungi and mushrooms, have you encountered any misconceptions from people in talking about those?
Yes, I have. I think, you know, some people have a fear of all mushrooms. You know, they heard that they're poisonous and, you know, have a fear. As Paul says in the film, you know, anything that can, you know, that can heal you, that can feed you, that can get you high or kill you, is sort of naturally feared. But that's true of a lot of things in nature. You don't just go on a hike and eat any berry that you see on a trail. You obviously have to be knowledgeable about what you can eat or not eat. I think that, you know, the mushrooms are kind of clandestine. They're hiding all the time. Sometimes they'll pop up, sometimes they don't. They are mysterious. And I think that creates a lot of mystery. And some people like to dive into the mystery, and perhaps some people are scared of the mystery.
Right. And the role that we think of mold playing is not one that's necessarily celebrated, but it's a part of life.
Well, you're right, because most people think of mold, which is a form of fungi, as, you know, the decomposition is the end of life. You know, you find it like on a peach, you know, on your countertop, on fruit, and you realize when you die, you will probably, if you're buried, you will decompose. But on the other hand, you could say it's the beginning of life. If we didn't break down organic matter, we would choke on all the stuff, and there would be no rebirth, no regeneration. So we need them. It's like recycling. If there was no recycling on the planet, even with the garbage that mankind is creating, pretty soon we would all choke on all the stuff. That if we can't reuse it, repurpose it, then it would be a major disaster. So nature has always been the best recycler. Fungi are the recyclers of nature. So whether you call it the end of life or the beginning of life, it's a circle of life.
Right. Yeah, well said. So what do you hope the reaction to this film will be?
Well, I think that the reaction I've seen so far is it gives a lot of people hope, especially young people who are facing this giant environmental, you know, potential apocalyptic future with climate change. And, you know, saying in 20, 30, 40 years, you know, we could have devastating effects on the planet. We've already lost almost like 50% of our species. So we're not going in the right direction here. And when you can discover and learn that there are there's a giant kingdom in nature that is here to heal us, that is a giant immunity builder, that is able to recycle, that is able to clean the atmosphere, it gives us hope. All we need to do is perhaps, you know, encourage scaling it by by not using pesticides, by not using GMOs, by doing no-till agriculture. Let's allow this symbiotic relationship under the ground between the mycelium network and plants and trees to flourish. And if we do that, according to many scientists, if we stop putting fossil fuel contamination and CO2 into the atmosphere, if we actually stopped it, we could clean the atmosphere in as little as 5 years. So, you know, we don't need to necessarily spend $1 billion on coming up with a high-tech solution to figure out how to create a giant vacuum cleaner to clean the atmosphere from all the pollution we put into it. We just got to let nature do its thing. And then I think the other big takeaway, and that sort of the film ends on this note, something that I had no idea about, was this idea of interconnectedness, this idea that the mycelium network builds bridges underground between different plants, between trees, between a mother tree and its own baby tree, and that is nature's operating instructions. And why use that as a guide or as a model for how we live our lives above the ground? You know, a shared economy, not based on greed. When ecosystems flourish, everybody benefits. The birds, the insects, the plants, the mammals, human beings. We all benefit from a healthy living environment.
Right. So is there anything else that you'd like to impart to our listeners today?
Well, I hope to go see the movie at, I think it's Cinema 21, and that they tell their friends about it, that they become part of the mycelial network by sharing that information. They can go to fantasticfungi.com, and they can see the 25 different cities we're opening this film. We're relying on social media and, you know, interviews like this to spread the word. We don't have a marketing or an advertising budget, yet we are so far proving the fact that there is a lot of interest for people to come together, to have this shared experience, to talk about interconnection, to figure out how we can help our local communities thrive by getting involved in permaculture, foraging, gardening. Oregon is leading the nation by having maybe the first ballot initiative to decriminalize psilocybin, so that people that are suffering from anxiety or severe cancer diagnosis can get some help. You guys are pioneering it, so I'm asking everyone to potentially spread the word, spread the spores of wisdom, so we can have this conversation and let it go globally.
Awesome. Spread the spores of wisdom. I like that. Well, Louis, thank you so much for talking to me. I appreciate you taking the time.
Okay. Thank you so much for helping to spread the spores and love. And it's an honor to be here in Portland. I'll be here Friday night, Saturday night. And again, it's going to be great to be a catalyst for a movement that's going to be bigger than we think.
Awesome. Well, Louis Schwartzberg, thank you so much for talking to me.
Okay. Take care.
You too. That was Louis Schwartzberg, director of the new film Fantastic Fungi, screening at Cinema 21 through October 10th. Louis will be in attendance tomorrow, Saturday, September 28th, at the 4 p.m. show. I have been Althea Billings. Thanks for listening.
And we are coming up at the top of the hour at KBOO Portland, and this is Rabia coming to you from Membership Central. The number for you to call now is 877-500-5266. That was so interesting. I learned a lot about fungi and mycelium just in that brief half an hour, so much. And I hope that you learned a lot, too. I'm super excited about the legalization of psilocybin and the use of psychedelics to treat different maladies or ailments, or simply to explore your brain. And I think you're excited about that too. And if you are, call us now. Become a member of KBOO, 877-500-5266. Be part of be part of our network. Be like fungi and give us a call, 877-500-5266. We know it's all connected, and we're so well connected today that we've got one of our members has generously donated a $1,500 match. And what that means is that every dollar you donate to KBOO today, right now, will be matched by another individual who believes in this radio station in the same way that you do. They value what they hear and listen to in the same way that you do. 877-500-5266. Make your donation in Greta Thunberg's name. What an amazing climate champion that young lady is. And she's my role model. That's all I can say. I love how she speaks out so directly and clearly for the cause of our environment. And that's your environment and mine. And we only have one. We all share it. So in the same way that we all share the airwaves with this radio station, 877-500-5266. Give a call now. We're coming up at the top of the hour. It's News and Public Affairs Day. And we just have an amazing day full of knowledge and information. Your brain is going to be so huge at the end of this day. It is going to be filled with information. So call now, 877-500-5266. Become a member. Support your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Pearl Bakery, a bakery located in the Pearl District at 102 Northwest 9th Avenue. Pearl Bakery was founded locally in 1997, featuring artisan breads, pastries, and coffee. More information can be found at pearlbakery.com. Lunch was provided by Horse Brass Pub, located at 4534 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. Open from 11 to 2 a.m., serving British and pub grub. More information can be found at horsebrass.com. Dinner was provided by Di Nicola's, located in the Creston Kenilworth neighborhood at 3520 Southeast Powell Boulevard. Di Nicola's authentic Italian restaurant has been a family-run Portland institution for over 40 years, serving Italian cuisine and pizza, open daily from 4 to 9 p.m. or later. For information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 or go to